Hey, everybody. Welcome to Season 3 of Fearless Women Podcast. Thanks for joining us weekly as we bring you inspiring true stories from around the world. I'm Janice McDonald, your host and global champion for women. For more great stories, pick up a copy of my beautiful best-selling book, Fearless, Girls with Dreams, Women with Vision. It's available everywhere. A big shout out to our listeners from all around the globe, including USA, UK, Canada, France, Zimbabwe, Mongolia, Japan, and so many more countries. Hello. I love, love, love having you join us. I'm thinking about you, and I hope you're doing all right out there. Well, my fearless listeners, these remain challenging times, and our resilience continues to be tested. I am so excited to welcome on the show a truly inspiring intellectual. Let me tell you just a little bit from her very impressive bio. Dr. Vardit Ravitsky is a professor of bioethics at the University of Montreal and at Harvard Medical School. She is immediate past president and currently vice president of the International Association of Bioethics. She's director of ethics and health at the Center for Research on Ethics and holds a research creation chair on the reappropriation of maternity. She's a 2020 fellow of the Pierre Elliott Trudeau Foundation, which is how we met, and chaired the foundation's COVID-19 Impact Committee. She is also a fellow of the Canadian Academy of Health Sciences and of the Hastings Center. She has published more than 200 papers on ethics. There's so much more to her impressive career. I've only done a small highlight of her incredible achievements. I am delighted to welcome the brilliant Dr. Vardit Ravitsky to the show. Welcome.
Thank you, Janice, for having me. After such an introduction, there's only the way down now.
It's up with you. Let me tell you, let's start with your work. So this is incredibly important work, and you're spending time, obviously, at University of Montreal and at Harvard Medical School. Give us the scoop.
My work focuses on how biotechnologies, especially new ones, impact individuals, families, and society in general. So there are so many things that we can actually do now that only a little time ago seemed like science fiction. We can test, we can get embryos out of the human body, and then we can test them and know practically anything about their DNA before choosing which one to implant in the uterus. So we have an unprecedented degree of control over the identity of children that the children that we're having, and consequently on the composition of our future society. We have the capacity to keep people alive much longer. We have the capacity to test individuals, sequence their entire genome, know who's related to whom, and identify past criminals based on DNA. There's so much that we can do. What fascinates me is that often the technology is there, but that doesn't tell us how best to use it or in what ways we should not use it. What uses are dangerous? And that's where people like me come in. We look at the technologies as what's possible, and we ask the tough questions about what should be done.
Just tell us more. This is so fascinating. Just keep going, Vardit. I just want to hear all about your work. It's clear you love it. Just tell us more.
The reason I love this area of work so much, the reason it's been such a passion for more than three decades now, is that it really combines my three favorite things. On one hand, scientific innovation, all these emerging technologies. Sometimes it's almost science fiction. The second element is ethics. I really like discussions of right and wrong, just and unjust. I find that where our humanity really comes out is when we think as individuals and as communities about what we should do, not just what we can do. And the third element that really captured me early on in life was the philosophical, conceptual novelty of this. So I'll give you an example. For thousands of years, women had babies, right? That was like the most obvious thing in the world. We never had to ask ourselves, who is the mother, because a woman would get pregnant, she would carry a pregnancy, she would deliver a baby. If she was lucky, she survived this whole dangerous process. But that was it. She was the mother. 44 years ago, for the first time ever in the history of our species, we managed to get a human egg out of the female body, fertilize it with human sperm, and the embryo in vitro in a lab dish survived. And it started developing, and we were able to put it back in uterus. That's just a scientific biological achievement, right? But then all the doors open to the social, ethical, and legal questions that emerge from that very simple fact. So now the first thing we realized was, wait, we don't have to put that embryo back in the uterus of the woman who gave us the egg. Maybe we can put it in another woman. Let's see what happens. Will it survive there? We tried it, and yes, it survived. And what was born was a surrogate mothers. And today, a multi-billion dollar market of surrogate women, gestational mothers all over the world, mostly in poor countries who carry babies for couples from rich countries. So you see how fast we move from such a simple scientific biological achievement to a host of issues about who gets to use this, for what reasons, cross-border uses. Those babies were born in India to a couple from France. When they come back to France, they don't get citizenship because France doesn't acknowledge this practice. The mind boggles with the number of issues that arise here. Then we realize that not only we can take this embryo from the dish and put it in any woman that we want, but that we can test its DNA before we do that. And now we can tell you about thousands of genetic conditions and even traits, eye color, of that embryo before it's even in a uterus. So now we're asking questions about how we're having babies and what kind of babies we're having and what would be the impact of this on how we perceive disability and disease and diversity in society. We basically hold the key to who gets to be born. We also do that during pregnancy because we have very powerful technologies to test the fetus during pregnancy, and then we can terminate. In comes the issue of abortion. So just a couple of examples of how these new technologies constantly push our thinking about basic concepts like parenthood, motherhood, disability, health, diversity, human society, you know, what children to have, what is a family. So we have these challenges to very basic concepts, but we constantly also have questions of right and wrong and how to create new legal frameworks to protect the most vulnerable in all of this, the women, the children, the surrogates, those who aren't even born yet, but who will suffer potentially from discrimination because of the decisions we're making now. So that's the space that I operate in. I have to keep track of all these new technical biological possibilities in order to constantly unpack what they mean for ethics and law and society. And my main concern is always the protection of vulnerable parties, and especially what this means for women.
It's fascinating. It's scary. It's exciting. And where my mind goes to while you're talking about this is, you know, who decides and who decides who decides and who's watching, who's deciding. And it's very, very, very heavy stuff. And, you know, it's clear why it matters. When you think about all these different issues as they're playing out around the world, what are you afraid of, Bardit? Like, what are you worried about? What, like, do you tend to be more excited about this, or are you fearful? You know, give us that sense as you look out the future of technology, the issues on the horizon, the many, many issues, the complex issues.
That's such a great question, Janice, the million-dollar question. So first of all, as for who decides, that's a part of the ethical debate, precisely. Mm-hmm. Those of us who are lucky enough to live in liberal democracies, who will eventually decide is decision makers. You know, our parliaments will vote. But just last night, I attended the Canadian Science Policy Conference, where the scientists and the policymakers get together to think about how science and ethics should inform policy. So the democratic process does its thing, but the interesting question is, where do people like me and clinicians and scientists get into this conversation in order to explain these complexities to decision makers who will vote on, you know, these laws and regulations that will create the framework of our lives? How do we inform them in a way that is accurate, but also accessible, comprehensible, and in a way that takes all this data, whether scientific or ethical, and allows them to actually put it into action so that they create better rules for us? And that's an entire area of study in and of itself. So who's deciding? You know, democracy, but with a lot of input from experts. Who is an expert? Who counts as an expert? Here's another area of study. So the deeper you go, the more you start unpacking each of these questions, there's an entire research domain that looks at that question very closely. And to me, the big issue is, how do we take all that rich knowledge and just pass it on to where it matters? You know, I can spend a day reading, you know, 20 articles on a very, very targeted question, and I will become very well informed. But that's in my head. Now, what do I do with that? How do I communicate it to patients, to clinicians, to labs, and obviously to governments? So a huge part of my job is writing reports for governments that take all this complexity and simplifies it, synthesizes it, so that they can actually run with it. Your other question that is really fantastic is, am I more excited or more afraid? And, you know, when I look around the landscape of bioethicists who work in these domains, genetics, reproduction, regenerative medicine, artificial intelligence and health, all those really sexy, shiny new possibilities, I almost identify two schools of thought. One, I call the scared one, a general feeling of, oh my God, this is all coming. We can't stop it. How do we stop it? Or at least how do we slow it down? A sense of threat, a sense of, you know, things are changing too fast and we don't have the ethical conceptual tools to deal with it, as if bioethics is there to slow things down and to create barriers. And I'm not a part of that school. I'm the school of excitement, enthusiasm. All these technologies are here to make our lives better, to give us choices, to make us better informed, to keep us healthier, to give us more time on this earth. So I see bioethics as a facilitator, because I think if we implement all these novel possibilities responsibly, then we'll get to benefit from them. If we do it irresponsibly, either they'll harm us or the public will get so scared that it will start seeing them as dangerous and want us to stop them. So to me, bioethics is a facilitator. It's about removing barriers so that all these things can come into our lives responsibly in a way that we can trust them and really enjoy what they have to offer. So yeah, I'm jumping out of bed every morning excited to see what new technologies are there awaiting and how my work, the work of my team, the work of my entire field of bioethics can pave the way for these technologies to come into our lives.
And when they come into our lives, and they're coming, ready or not, here they come. What is interesting to me, and what I think about when I'm hearing your robust answers on the issues, if we don't hear from some people, and if some perspectives are not part of those conversations, how of concern that can be. So can you kind of pick up, and even as it relates to, you know, who gets born and the choices that are made, the value and importance of diverse perspectives, both in this field, but, you know, in the wider context as well?
Of course, because think about just some of the notions that I've been throwing around: abortion, end of life, who gets to be born, what will be the composition of future societies, how do we define what a family is, who's going to be allowed to have kids, should we have kids at all in these times of climate crisis? On each of these, and that's just a handful, you have extremely diverse perspectives. Some of them come from religious differences, some from political commitments, some just come from the fact that we have different understandings of the science itself, different interpretations. So if we allow a conversation that is sort of dominated by just a handful of experts, we are going to have too many blind spots to have good outcomes. And this is increasingly recognized in my domain, of course, because we're talking about social and ethical implications, but even in science. So let me give you an example. Scientific studies used to be designed by scientists. You had an interesting question about a certain genetic mutation. Does it or does it not underlie a certain disease? And if so, how can we treat it? And you would design your study, you, your colleagues in your lab. Over the years, even scientists started recognizing the design of the study and even the choice of what question to address requires the participation of those who will be impacted by the outcomes. So if you're going to study the gene for breast cancer, talk to the communities where this mutation is most prevalent who will be impacted by the gene being identified, screening programs being offered, treatments being improved. Include disabled people when you discuss conditions leading to disability. Include indigenous communities if you want to study indigenous DNA. And not just as an add-on, not at the stage of, oh, we studied your genetics and we now have an answer, so here it is, we'll tell you what it is. No, even before you start thinking about what to study, because you want to talk about what matters. And scientists sometimes are exceptionally curious about things that don't really matter to those who will be impacted. So today, part of the work that people like me do is to bring everybody together around one table, right from the beginning, even before we conceive the studies, but definitely during the study and when the outcomes are disseminated. So this diversity is now embedded into the research and the thinking, not just in bioethics, but even in science.
It's incredibly important that, and I love that you picked this up, the framing of the question at the outset that doesn't involve, as you've indicated, you know, those impacted. It seems so obvious, and yet here it is. It's so necessary.
Yeah, it took a while. It took a long time to recognize that.
So you have this absolutely incredible list of achievements, and you're just getting started. I want to understand, take us back a little bit on the journey of you. First of all, can you share with us a time that you would define yourself as having been fearless?
I have several reactions to this question, and some of them go way back to the time that I was a PhD student, and as a woman in Israel, I kind of struggled to make myself heard and was struggling to get myself to the correct type of table in order to have a voice there, and a lot of imposter syndrome that everybody talks about, and who am I? What do I know? What do I have to contribute? And then just pushing yourself to the front and saying, no, I do matter. And maybe I'll have one idea, one that nobody else thought about. And that will be my contribution. And that's enough. So I will push forward to the table. But I have a more recent and more concrete example. And that was the work I did during COVID. A lot of media exposure, because I felt as a bioethicist that I have a responsibility to communicate to the public, to convince the public that science is a thing, that public health measures are based on evidence, even though it is evolving and shifting. And we were learning frantically about the virus, about the transmission, and then about the vaccines. And the public was very confused, obviously, not to mention the conspiracy theories. So I decided to fearlessly put myself out there in front of the camera, the microphone, whoever wanted to hear about the ethical principles behind the public health measures. And often that meant that I was promoting vaccination, defending government decisions, explaining why all those public health measures that we were suffering from are needed and necessary. And people were not happy, of course. So I was targeted by anti-vaxxers groups. I was accused of being paid under the table by pharma and the government for saying things. And it ended up even with personal threats, very, very ugly expressions on social media. It's a very targeted effort to discredit you when people don't like what you're saying. And you need to just make a decision if you have what it takes to stay out there and keep talking, or if this is too much of a threat to you, especially with the death threats when the police got involved. You know, I have kids. This was a family decision whether mom is going to shut up going forward or continue. And I had the support of my colleagues and my family, and I just kept at it because, you know, it was a public health emergency. It was important. We all felt it was important work and that it was worth it. So that's a very concrete example of deciding that fear is not going to manage you and that the cause that you're working for is worth it.
And thank you for doing it. It's incredibly important. You kind of said it breezily, the death threats and the, you know, the constant barrage of negativity and the insults, et cetera. I know you've linked it to the value and importance of the work and, you know, directly to the need to ensure that your voice is heard and that the public understands the importance of the work that you were doing and why it matters. But can we just talk for a second, like, you know, in that family context, and you've indicated it was a family decision, but this is heady stuff that, you know, as you're not signing up for as part of your job. And yet here it is. I think it's scary when we think about it in terms of voices being heard and also why women have to keep doing it, but so many step back and say, I won't do it. And yet you did and continue to.
So it's so interesting, Janice, that you said that we don't sign up for it, but in a way, in bioethics, you kind of do sign up for it, especially if you're going to be working in reproduction and genetics, because way before COVID, you know, I used to go to conferences about embryo research and there were demonstrators outside calling us baby murderers because right. We worked with embryos, in vitro embryos, right? So right. It's not like I haven't been attacked before. I try to promote prenatal testing for informed choice, but it's very easy to make the wrong step and be accused as not promoting enough disability rights. I mean, there are 1,000 ways to do this wrong. And if you're lucky, one way to do it right. It's all in framing and terminology and being extremely nuanced and balanced and always talking to all the stakeholders to make sure you've got the language right and you've got the framing right. So I've been there before. COVID was particularly vicious and particularly political and therefore dramatic. Mm-hmm. But I think if you choose to do bioethics and emerging technologies, you will be targeted at one point or another. And if you can't take it, then just don't engage, right? Write your books, right. Write your papers. Don't talk to the media. Don't go to conferences. Stay in your office. Otherwise, as soon as you're putting yourself out there, somebody will not like your work or the way you're presenting it. And you do sign up for it.
Yeah. And thank you for clarifying that. By its very nature, it's controversial. But nevertheless, you're remarkably fearless because you may have people not agreeing with your work, but you typically don't think that that's going to lead to death threats, as an example. You're incredibly fearless. What's something you wish you knew earlier?
You know, when I started my career as an academic, I was so focused on the content. I thought it's just about an idea, a paper, an argument, a concept. So when I started collaborating first with small groups and now with big national and international groups, I was always just putting the content at the center of the conversation and pushing the analysis forward. And what I wish I had known earlier is to what degree work also depends on personal relationships, on the people. When you work in a group, and obviously in my field, you have to because of the plurality of perspectives and the plurality of disciplines and methodologies. You know, I work with scientists and sociologists and epidemiologists and statisticians. You need a lot of people around the table to do the work right from a, you know, from a substantial perspective. But that means that you have a lot of people who were trained in different fields. They don't necessarily speak each other's language. and to build those bridges across our scientific and methodological cultures, we need to get to know each other as people to build the trust. And I wish I had known earlier how important it is to have the personal aspect of doing science and doing bioethics established and also nourished along the way. And not just so that the work environment will be more pleasant, but actually to have better outcomes. Today, I know that, you know, it's so important to get to know people personally, to have time to chat about our families, our dogs, our vacations, to really understand where people are coming from. Why did they end up in this career? Just the same questions you're asking me now. Get to know people as people. And that's something that today I'm so aware of, and I see it play out. COVID was a huge challenge to that, right? The 3 years of virtual interactions left us with very little space to talk about kids and dogs. Mm-hmm. But we're picking up now again. And it also makes life so much nicer. You know, when I work, I feel like I'm in a party with friends. Because I actually know the people. I've been to their home. They've been to mine. I try to host work events at home. I try to, on Facebook, mix up the personal and the professional. I just think relationships are key to what we're trying to achieve in terms of research and eventually also even at the level of decision making. So that's a big part of what the more mature me is now trying to build.
I think that's so insightful, and it goes beyond your specific career. I think that's applicable for everybody to focus on the people and to develop those relationships. And just to echo the word, you know, you talked about trust, and trust is built over time. And as you indicated, as we get to know each other and the richness of that, and as you indicated, the better outcomes, that does happen because when we trust, then we're willing to bring our full selves forward. And very practical. Thank you for sharing that. So here you are with this, as I said, remarkable career, and you're just getting started. But take us all the way back. Like, let's hear about the 10-year-old you. Were you as fearless as you are now? What, you know, what were you into then? Where did you live? What was interesting to the 10-year-old Vardit?
I grew up in Jerusalem in a very homogeneous Orthodox Jewish community. Most people around me had the same political views and dressed similar. We had no very strict dress code. And girls were supposed to grow up to do certain things and boys slightly different things. 10-year-old me was all into my friends, boys, I think, already. but mostly reading. There was no internet. There was only one TV channel at the time, and it only worked a few hours a day. So I used to read for hours. And I think one of the, when I look at, back at where I came from, I didn't speak English or French. I could only speak Hebrew. I've never left the country. First time I left the country, I was 13. So I had very little exposure to otherness. And I think already at that early age, I was tremendously curious about diversity. How do people live in other countries, other culture? What is it like to speak another language? What are other people's norms and values, and how are they different? I was drawn to diversity before I even knew what it was or before I could put any content into it.
Was that because of your reading? Like, so you read about different lives and different places. Like, was that the source of that desire or interest?
I think that was one source. But another one is, I think it's a matter of personality. I think some people thrive in the known and something more homogeneous. That's their comfort zone. And I think personality, like something very fundamental in who I am, was just craving difference. And even today, if you think about what I do, I thrive in the in-between. I'm between disciplines, between methodologies, between topics. I work on things that constantly evolve. As I said, you know, every morning I open the news and there's a new technology that I have to work on. So I think my comfort zone is in difference and in translating across different types of thinking and different types of seeing. And it's in constant change. I think I need very high degrees of stimulation to keep interested and to keep motivated. So my comfort zone is constantly being out there and checking out what is new and what is different. And I remember feeling it so early on because it didn't align with my, you know, with the environment that I grew up in. So I'm actually the only one of my, you know, I come from a big tribe. I'm the only one who lives outside of Israel. I'm the only one who works in, not in Hebrew. I'm the only one who works sort of in the interface of science and other things. Everybody else is in humanities. They're all philosophers and educators and politicians. Yeah, I'm a little bit of the black sheep.
And yet, what I'm hearing, though, from such an early age, it's like this, I don't know if it would have been at 10, like this self-reflection, but this like knowing of yourself, like there's more and I want it. And then you've been in pursuit of. And I find that so fascinating, given, as you've indicated, the whole tribe is still there. So there, it must have been like a source of friction as you're excited about the world and all that that goes with it. And yet here you are, you left that behind and continue to pursue. It's very exciting to hear.
On one hand, yeah, friction at some points. Yes, I left early on, went to study in France and then in the US. And then I came back to Israel. I went again to the US, to Canada. Every few years, I moved to another country and kind of progressing in my career. But over the years, back to relationships and trust, everything was rebuilt. And today, I could not be closer to this tribe. They are my source of strength. They are my biggest cheerleaders. I share everything. I visit several times a year. It's a happy end. It's a story with a happy end, because even though, you know, breaking out of it, you know, had to pay a price, I ended up going back stronger. And they really embraced me with all their hearts. So I couldn't be more grateful for that journey.
What is your advice for ambitious women who want to make a difference? Your passion is so palpable and you're so driven. Others who want to follow in your footsteps.
Obviously, listen to yourself. If you have a passion, run with it. Give it a shot. If from an early age or midlife or any time in your life that you recognize what motivates you, give it everything you've got and try to run with it. At the same time, you know, everybody says, follow your heart, follow your dreams. I'm ambivalent about these messages because some girls, some women, some people don't have the opportunities. They don't have the access. With all the passion and all the dreams, the doors are just not opening. And they don't have the possibility, or they have to have a day job to pay the bills. I know how privileged I am that I can make a living following my passion. That is not a possibility for everybody. So yeah, listen to yourself, identify your inner strength and your passion and try to do it. And if life doesn't allow for it, then, you know, do what you need to do to survive and try to find a place for that passion elsewhere in your life to keep it alive. Because I think really those passions, those of us who have them, that's what keeps us going. That's what gets us out of bed in the morning and gives us the energy throughout the day and throughout our lives. And those of us who are privileged enough to sit in these places, try to open doors for others. Try to make it possible for young people to follow their dreams. Because you got to remember that it wasn't easy for you. And for some people, it's even harder.
Door open and hand back. I couldn't agree with you more, Ardit. So final question. What's your dream for the world?
My dream for the world is for especially girls, but everybody, to live without fear. Without fear of their access to education being taken away. Without fear for their lives because they're in a war. Without fear of hunger. Without fear of disease. Now I'm becoming a little bit utopian here. But so many in the world right now are just coping with, you know, with survival and with terrible fear every day. And it can be anything from, you know, what am I going to, will I have opportunities and the rest of my life, to will I even survive? And in terms of justice, global justice, climate crisis, I just hope we make the right decisions now so that, you know, our grandchildren, yours and mine, Janice, will live with at least less fear than some of the kids around the world today.
Well, thank you for sharing your beautiful dream. I am grateful that you are at the tables you are at, helping to make the world a better place. I shared with everybody what a brilliant person you are, and we're just getting started in our conversation. So I hope you will promise to come back and that we can pick up on some of the many themes and the incredibly important work that you're doing in the world. And thank you so much. What an absolute pleasure to have the brilliant Dr. Vardeet Ribitsky on the show today. Will you come back? I'm putting you on the spot. Will you come back again?
I promise. And thank you so much for having me. What a delight to talk to you.
Oh, thank you again. You have been listening to, as I mentioned, the brilliant Dr. Vardeet Ribitsky on the Fearless Women podcast.
Thanks for listening. We want our community to grow. Tell your friends, follow us on Instagram, and sign up for our newsletter at fearlesswomenpodcast.com to get the early scoop. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts or in your favorite app. And if you like what you hear, give us a 5-star rating. I'm Janice McDonald. Stay fearless.